You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Pick My Brain is the podcast where founders pitch me their startup and I try to give them some useful advice so they can connect better with potential co-founders, investors, media, and of course, customers. My name's Alan Jones and I was a founder myself for about 15 years, and after that an angel investor for another 15 years, so yeah, old. Some of my ventures have been successful and some failed disastrously, but I like to think I've learned a thing or two along the way, and maybe some of that can help you. So if you'd like to learn how to tweak your pitch, subscribe to the Pick My Brain show now, wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
I found that, you know, founders get stuck on their ideas rather than the outcomes. So there's like this, you know, this is the problem that we're solving and this is how we're doing it. And it's hard sometimes to disconnect the goal with the product.
Welcome to FinTech Fun. FinTech Fun is a podcast where Australian fintechs come to share their stories.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here. As part of the FinTech Fun podcast, I'm joined by Ben Williamson, co-founder and CEO of Fresh Equities, or Fresh. What do you want to call it, Ben?
Yeah, so Fresh is kind of like the head co now. It's like the catch-all.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, welcome. Welcome to the podcast and thanks for coming on.
Cheers, man.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ben, let's talk about Fresh, mate. The early days, how the idea started and how it all began, the business itself.
Sure. Interestingly, so my co-founder and I, so my co-founder's Rhys Davis, we've been friends for probably about 9 years now. His now wife and my wife have been best friends for 25 or 30 years. And when he and Sam started dating, we were the couple that got brought out to veto or give input or those sorts of things after they'd been dating for a few weeks. And we got introduced and it took about 12 minutes for him and I to just like wander off and have a beer, and we were fast friends very quickly, which was fantastic. And he really opened my eyes to a lot of things, startups as one. I wasn't really into startups at the time. Sort of a first principles approach. Like my background is I'm an ex-auditor. I was at KPMG. I was at Telstra. Then I worked in a whole bunch of fast growth companies as well. You know, companies like True Value Solar, which went in 3 years, its top line revenue went 7 mil, 21 mil, 220. Wow. So, you know, three bagged and then 10 bagged on top, just crazy numbers. So I had really good exposure to fast growing SMEs, but startup was a different game, and definitely approaching problems from a first principle point of view just wasn't sort of how I was educated, shall we say. So we worked for a while together, just sort of throwing ideas. You know, I'm sure a lot of the listeners of here have done with their friends.
I'll just throw ideas around. I've had about 400 of them, so
that's it. And ideas are cheap. And we'd played with a lot of different aspects. We nearly bought a pram business, an online pram business. We nearly started a social media app for pickup games, and that got pretty close. And we ended up coming together on a project called DealPad, which was the precursor to Fresh. DealPad was something that we'd been working on offline for a bit. We brought together and raised some seed funding after we got customer validation. And that was a sales funnel, like a SaaS sales funnel, but for private companies raising capital. So it allowed you to asynchronously take people through the sales journey, education, sort of, you know, through awareness, education, engagement, commitment, and close. And we helped a bunch of startups raise their seed and Series A rounds in that. And we did about 20, 25 companies, something like that, in the 6 months that it was alive. And it was really strong, but the market for it was very small. And, you know, you would end up having to take a relatively large fee out of someone who was raising, you know, their first sort of half a mil or a mil. And it just wasn't how we wanted to scale. And luckily for us at the same time that we were going through that journey on whether or not we wanted to continue that business, we saw in the market that there were just people jumping up and down anytime a company went to raise money, a listed company. So you'd have an ASX listed company, there's 2,200 of them, about 800 or 900 raise every year. Most of them are quite small, but they've got a large band of engaged but arm's length shareholders. So people that are unknown to the company. And when a company went into a raise, they'd appoint their lead broker. The lead broker would then offer the deal to the people they know because it's only open for a day or two. And unfortunately, this sort of large group of highly engaged, high conviction investors just weren't able to access the discounted raise in the company that they know and like. So we saw this opportunity. We did some validation, and it was a Friday afternoon at about 3 o'clock. We decided sort of like, fuck it, let's just give it a go. And we,
I'm going to have to actually beep that out now using one of my whiz bang kits, you know that.
Surely it's all right to say that on this.
Look, it is perfectly fine, Ben. So continue on.
So to give a frame of reference for your listeners, we were about a year into DealPad at this time. We'd spent 6 months building before releasing, which in retrospect was a mistake. We thought we had the answer before we'd even built it. We had got some validation. So, you know, we had traction and people using it and people raising great outcomes. Monetization for us was the issue because we didn't necessarily want to monetize that upfront engagement. On the flip side, we were looking at this problem in the listed market. We had limited resources. There was just Reese and I full time, and we had a part time developer with us. Reese is a full stack dev as well. So, pretty limited resources. So, we had to be quite nimble about trying this. We wanted to give ourselves a fortnight to see what we could do in a fortnight, see if we could solve the problem. We got access. First of all, we just spun up a new website. We literally, I think we came up with fresh equities in about an hour in a boardroom with a whiteboard because the .com was available and it sort of matched what we're after. We then spun up like a landing page website. We got access to a transaction. I think it was like a Bell Potter-led transaction or something at the time. And we were just bidding through a third party who was bidding into it. And the goal was really, can we make this deal more accessible? And can we find one person who is a sophisticated investor, so able to participate, who wants to participate, without giving them any advice, and get them to, you know, go to this, you know, landing page, brand new brand website, and put in their details to subscribe for $10,000 or more. So can we get one person for 10 grand? And on the first offer that we did, we got six people for 300,000 total.
Wow.
Which was kind of insane. And the process was awful. We handed them over to another broker. They then had to like open an account with that broker same day But one person did and invested $50,000 and we earned some revenue on that first ever transaction. And then we thought, well, that was good. We hit our targets of, you know, one or more people for $10,000 or more, and we smashed that by 6 and 300. We did it in 10 days and not the 14 that we'd set. So that was great. But maybe it was a once-off. So we tested it again. And on the second try, we actually had someone who was a top, I think he was a top 30 shareholder. The company was raising, I think, $15 or $20 million. And this person wanted to invest $1.5 million in the business. And his lowest friction way of trying to do that was not to call his broker, was not to, you know, call the company or the broker running the deal. He didn't know who the broker running the deal was. It was to put his details into our website and press submit. And that was a really eye-opening activity that drove, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've worked on 1,500 transactions for more than $600 million.
Wow. And after you've established that there was a potential alignment, I suppose, from people that are interested in the company to existing shareholders, did the company or the broker or anyone know who these people were when they were taking the money up and moving forward to that next stage of potential identification and or feedback to the parties involved? How's that evolved?
Yeah, so it evolved quite a bit over the time. So it started off as a like a notice board service where we would essentially have a notice board of transactions, and investors would say, I'm interested in this. Think of it as you're walking into a travel agency and you've got a whole bunch of flyers on the wall.
Yeah.
Destinations, right? And they pick one up and they say, I'm interested in this. And we say, great, we'll pass your details on to the person
who's running it. California.
Correct.
Yep.
And that's how it started. So we didn't take care, you know, in that first instance, this didn't last for too long, but we didn't take care of KYC, AML. We didn't process anything. It was just a promotional aspect. Then we evolved to doing the KYC and AML and doing the sophisticated investor checks, et cetera, and started to then also process the transactions. So from a broker's point of view, it went from, you know, here are 10 people who all want 50 grand each, and you have to then go through and validate and KYC and AML and onboard them and take risk, et cetera, which gives them sometimes the upside of new customers and better knowledge of who they are. But the downside is that's a lot of paperwork on a day that you're running a transaction.
Mm. And because they're so short in time and short duration, it's, you know, they've got closing moments and relisting from their announcements to, you know, secondary trading. Okay. So if you don't get the money, I suppose, and the stock starts trading down or up or whatever, and then it's could be a tricky situation. Yeah.
Yeah. So we evolved that to be, from their point of view, we just gave them a single line bid of $500,000. We took care of everything. Say they allocated us $350,000 out of $500,000. We would take care of allocations. From their point of view, they just get $350K in as a line and the shares go out as a line.
Right. Okay. And then from your back end, you'd had to slice and dice individually, allocate.
Correct.
Accordingly to the bids and
which 90%+ of the time is just a pro rata allocation.
Yep. Of the actual bid size. And then from that point of view, being one line or being part of the deals, the numbers of deals and your presence grew. How did you grow your presence through that period of time?
Yeah. So, all of our growth for investors over that time was word of mouth. You know, people would go looking for the deal that they really, really want, find us, from people posting our links on social media, or someone saying, you know, hey, where do I, does anyone know where I can get access to this? And we just became known in the market as somewhere that was a faster way of doing it. Like, we had people, I remember, I think it was about an 86-year-old signed up and verified in 6 minutes. Like, that's insane, ready to go, full KYC, you know, AML. So for those that don't know your customer, anti-money laundering checks, S708. So are they a high net worth investor, sophisticated investor, ready to go? And that's because we made the really strong decision early on that we weren't going to hold the stock or cash. So when people sign up with Fresh Equities, they nominate the current broker that they have. So if you're with Morgan's and that's the broker that you like and that's the one you want to use, well, now you get access to 400 deals a year on top of Morgan's deals, but you keep all your money and your stock in the same spot.
Right. So settling direct with the broker.
Correct. Yeah.
Yep.
And whether it's a full service broker or a digital one.
Yep. And as the business evolved and you saw feedback and you saw your growth and your presence in the market, how's the business changed from that point?
Lots.
Always evolving.
Look, I think it's natural to continue to evolve a business. I think that, hunting for additional value is what has held us in very high stead. We wouldn't have made that change from DealPad to Fresh. We made more money, I think, in the first month of Fresh than we did in the year of DealPad.
Yeah, right.
Wow. As a commercial success, you know, DealPad was, you know, we were struggling to work out monetization with 2.5 of us. Now there's 28 people in Fresh. So it's a very good process, I think, to continue to evaluate. It's typically a very hard process, especially for founders. I found that, you know, founders get stuck on their ideas rather than the outcomes. So there's like this, you know, this is the problem that we're solving and this is how we're doing it. And it's hard sometimes to disconnect the goal with the product.
Mm.
And so I think people do struggle sometimes with that. That can be a tough one.
Do you reckon the goal changes or the product changes or both or somewhere in between?
I think it's a healthy evolution. So there are some people who wake up with this fully evolved goal, but I think that's very infrequent, especially amongst successful companies. Yep. So, you know, if you take Computershare, right? Very successful business. Australian born and bred. The Australian Registries business that most people listening and most of us would know Computershare for is less than 10% of their global revenue.
I don't think a lot of people would know that, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's like 7%.
Yep.
So you think about that, if they hadn't have evolved their goals, like it doesn't mean that they've gone away from, like evolving it doesn't mean you necessarily go away from what you set out to do. But if they hadn't gone international, if they hadn't gone into other aspects of their business, it just would be, you know, 1/14th of what they currently are.
Yep. And let's talk about Fresh's current and some milestones or some news about the business. You mentioned the numbers of staff that you've got. We're seeing a bit of a wild old market when it comes to private and public valuations. How's the business been tracking?
Yeah, really, really good. So last year we started to see that there were a couple of trends within the business forming. One was that we had a really, really strong way of engaging investors. So we treated investors as customers. And so when you do that, you start bringing in customer engagement models and onboarding flows and re-engagement loops and the data that you have around them and how do you move them through certain flows? How do you add value? What value are you adding? And there's a different view that we took to that to companies in the market treating investors and specifically shareholders. I think a lot of companies look at their current register and they're always looking for new shareholders, whereas the ones that they've got, they essentially treat like they're a past sale and the only thing that's going to come up is like a warranty claim.
Like a potential, like a buying a new car or something along those lines where it's a one-off and then after that it's like a service every year or something, but you can't sell that car again, so that's gone and the money's been made and the dollars and the margin's been banked.
But the flip is really what companies should be doing, and the way that we've always treated investors is they should be thinking about their shareholders as subscribers.
Yep.
So rather than they've bought the product once and now they can't add value, they're actually adding value every month, even just by not selling. And they're probably your best, you know, investors to get to buy more stock. Right, because they know the company, they've already made the decision to buy in. If you would actually engage with them, then they would, you know, allocate the next X funds there instead of another company. And so we saw that trend. We also saw our use of data and the fact that we'd worked on 1,500 transactions is, you know, a huge differentiator in the market. We've just seen a lot more. Even though we weren't running those deals, our breadth of vision was just unmatched. And we started to see certain patterns emerge. And then we started applying computer science to that and AI models as well. So what we did last year is we did two things that have really formed the basis for what I sort of call season two. So I sort of treat things as seasons. A season to me is 3 to 5 years of your life. It's usually a pretty formative period that you can kind of pull together. Maybe it's, you know, having kids or doing something personally. In most cases, it's a role at a company for most people in that sort of 3 to 5 year bracket. And this is really the start of season two for us. And the way that we got there is we saw these trends emerging, or this sort of depth of data that we had internally. And we did two key things last year. We got more involved in investor relations for companies. So to understand and to learn that area, we became essentially the outsourced IR firm for about a dozen companies for about 6 months to go on that journey and learn it. And what we were doing then is not just adding value to those companies, but internally, we were working out which parts of that could have value added through product. So we didn't want to, you know, long-term do the service aspect of it, but we wanted to understand where can product really play a powerful role here. And the second thing we did in December last year is we ran, rather than doing placements, which are that sort of, you know, 1 or 2 day event to third-party investors, we ran an enriched share purchase plan. So we helped a company who really wanted to raise, they wanted to raise $20 to $30 million. Our data and analytics said that they could. And we said we'd get a boost from that if we run it like we would run a deal, right? So that all the way back to that deal pad stuff, the sales funnel, how do you take people on the journey? How do you know where they are on the journey? What are the steps? How do you build engagement? How do you build
the loyalty? Yeah.
Loyalty, yeah, everything. And so we did that with those guys and we ended up raising $44 million in 2 weeks. Fantastic outcome. Wow. And all the allocations went to the right places and it was just fantastic. And so we took both of those into this year and we've just rebuilt over the last few months, we've rebuilt our entire tech stack. That was all the value sort of directed at us. We've now rebuilt directed to the company. And we launched that about 8 weeks ago now.
Yeah, right. Well done.
Thank you. And we just crossed $1 billion of market cap under admin for that product, which is fantastic. Mm. And probably something that I see us doubling in the next sort of 4 to 6 weeks as well.
Yeah, I think that's been a, you know, missing piece. Just and it's probably not through anyone's fault, I suppose. It's just that the tools and resources haven't been made available to management, to investor relations, to whatnot. And if you're filling that gap, that sounds like a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, I think from our point of view, no one had looked at this or no one had deemed to build it from a point of view of how do we connect the company to the shareholder more. I think most players try and sit between the company and the shareholder. You know, most sort of promotion services and the like. I'm not talking about IR firms or anything like that. They do a good job of connecting the investor to the company. But the third-party services are really about, you know, CommSec's probably a really good but underthought of product in this area. If you invest in CommSec or via CommSec, they don't provide your email address, et cetera, to the company for whatever reason they want to stay in the middle, and that's really to retain you and to get you trading more. And that's how they make money.
And, mate, now we'll shift off a little bit off Fresh and on to Ben himself. Mate, you're talking about seasons. What's been your season in the last 3 to 5 years, and where's your next season, do you think?
So, yeah, I think the last 3 to 5 years, probably the last 3 years for me personally, has been a bit of a rebuild. So when we launched Fresh and saw the great opportunity that we had in front of us, we were a single income family with two lovely girls, but in a nice house with a not so nice mortgage. And it became a choice of ours of whether we sell that house and get something much more affordable, or I work a night job or my wife goes back to work. And, you know, we very much value our family time, so we didn't want to remove that. So we essentially sold the house. I guess a fourth option was give up on the business, right? But we essentially sold the house for the business, and that was about 4 years ago now, 3 years ago now. And so since then it's been a bit of a rebuild personally. And it's been, you know, a very positive one, which is great. And on that upswing, which is even nicer. We've got a third girl now, which is fantastic as well. So Tess came into the world. She's just about to turn 2 next month. And so personally, that's kind of been my my journey. And I think as well, from my point of view, going through that phase of this is my first CEO gig. So going from 3 people to 28 has been a really great learning as well for me, and discovering what my strengths and weaknesses are in that area has been fantastic as well.
And never stop learning, especially with 3 kids. I've got 3 boys of my own, and every day is a different challenge, and highs and lows and low lows and high highs all the way through, mate. I'd like to thank you for telling the Fresh story, mate, and from the inception to where you are now. One final question I've got about the future, and you've grown the business, and as you said, to a multiple of your staff levels from when it was just the two of you, but putting your hat on in 12 months' time, where do you want to see the business?
Yeah, look, we've got pretty clear ideas. In 12 months, we're looking at over 100 companies, 100 ASX companies using the product to engage their shareholders, understand their shareholders, and potentially, you know, activate and raise from their shareholders as well. It's a really strong product where we don't, one of the big changes we made through that, which is really propelling our growth there, is that we don't participate in the raise fee. So we can help you raise, we can help your lead manager raise, we can help you with the shareholder offers, et cetera, and we don't charge any extra or participate in that. So that's been great, and that's really helped drive uptake as well. So I see more than 100. I see us also expanding overseas in that time. So we've got plans to either side of Christmas head over to the UK. Very similar market over there to here, and definitely something that our product fits in very well. And so we'll be, you know, conquering the ASX and getting our toehold into the LSE slash AIM.
Fantastic, mate. Thanks for sharing those plans and sharing the story from the early days and to where you want to go, and also touching on the personal life, which is certainly a big part of the founder journey. Appreciate you coming on and look forward to catching up.
Cheers, Chris. I really appreciate it.
For more information on Sub11, jump onto our LinkedIn or email me, chris@sub11.com.au. Thanks for listening.
Listen to the Unfunded podcast brought to you by the Day One Network and hosted by me, tech writer Joan Westenberg. We're sharing the no-holds-barred untold stories from entrepreneurs who have decided to build a business on their terms. I'll be interviewing successful founders and operators on the grit and ingenuity it takes to build and scale independent startups without the support of traditional venture capital funding. Subscribe to the Unfunded podcast now, wherever you get your podcasts.